TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Michael Rupert, Crossing the Rubicon. This is part two of a speech given at the prestigious San Francisco Commonwealth Club on August 31st, 2004. In part one, you heard Mike Rupert investigate the investigators. He backed up his serious charges of conflict of interest on the part of the official 9/11 Commission. In this program, Rupert makes good on the promise to show proof and even name names of U.S. government officials who he says knew of the September 11 attacks and helped them along. Mike Rupert was a detective with the L.A. Police Department when he found that the CIA was involved in bringing cocaine into the black neighborhoods of Los Angeles. Rupert lost his job and began his own investigative work, first into drug running by the U.S. government and the uses made of these huge amounts of cash for covert action and on the stock market. He also has written and campaigned on the phenomenon of peak oil. Rupert believes that the events of 9/11 were used, even orchestrated, to begin a war on terror around the world that conveniently focuses on oil supplies and oil trade routes. The stakes are high, since the survival of the U.S. empire depends on access to oil. You can find Mike Rupert's research on drugs, oil, and 9/11 on his website, fromthewilderness.com. That's fromthewilderness.com, and in his new book, Crossing the Rubicon. Here is Mike Rupert, recorded at the San Francisco Commonwealth Club in August of 2004.
Both here and in the United States and around the world, I am not alone in believing that the attacks of September 11th were facilitated, orchestrated, and executed by the United States government. However, there is a great deal of misunderstanding and conclusion jumping about these assessments that is not supported by the evidence. I was trained as a police officer and a detective, and for many years now I have been an effective investigative journalist because I have adhered to strict evidentiary and investigative procedures. The 9/11 attacks were the result of deliberate planning and orchestrated efforts by identifiable leaders within the United States government and the energy and financial sectors of this economy to see a Pearl Harbor-like attack which would provide the American empire with a pretext for war, invasion, and the sequential confiscation of oil and natural gas reserves or the key transportation routes through which they pass. 9/11 was a premeditated murder, and in my book, and here tonight, I will name some of the suspects who committed the crime. In my book, I will show you overwhelming evidence of their guilt, which I would be proud and confident to place either before a district attorney or a jury. Historically, the assertion that the United States government would orchestrate an attack upon American interests has ample precedent. Former National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski, I didn't see his picture on the wall outside, described the need for such an event in several places in his 1997 book, The Grand Chessboard. It was I who first brought this book to world attention in late 2001. The Project for a New American Century made reference to the need for such an attack in its 2000 report, Rebuilding America's Defenses. Declassified top secret documents disclosed by author James Banford in his book Body of Secrets tell us that in 1962, the Joint Chiefs had approved a plan called Operation Northwoods, which was a covert operation that would shoot down American aircraft and stage attacks on American military facilities with the intent of blaming those attacks on Fidel Castro, and thus prompting the subsequent invasion and U.S. occupation of Cuba. The declassified Northwood documents can be seen and downloaded from the FTW website. But once viewed, they cannot be ignored. Therefore, it cannot be said that such a thing has never been conceived of or carried out by American political leaders, from the sinking of the battleship Maine to the Gulf of Tonkin, and indeed even to Pearl Harbor itself. History today provides us with abundant documentation of U.S. government complicity in varying degrees in similar attacks. The book Day of Deceit and other records from the National Archives have shown us that the Roosevelt administration had broken the Japanese codes well before December 7th, and that a conscious decision was made to allow the attacks upon Pearl Harbor to take place. This was intended to provide the necessary impetus for U.S. entry into the Second World War at a time when Great Britain was buckling under the military blitzkrieg, aerial bombing, and unrestrained U-boat warfare of the Third Reich. Crossing the Rubicon is a detective story. It gets to the innermost core of the 9/11 attacks. It places 9/11 at the center of a desperate new America, created by specific named individuals in preparation for peak oil, an economic crisis like nothing the world has ever seen. Simply defined, for those of you who may not know, peak oil is that moment in time when global oil and natural gas production begins an irreversible and permanent decline, which will not yield or give way regardless of how much money and effort is spent trying to change it. With demand still accelerating rapidly in both the U.S. and industrialized nations in the developing world, the arrival of peak oil literally describes a point of overshoot in which economic and ecological stasis, let alone growth, becomes unsustainable over the course of the last 3 years and for the rest of human history. From the wilderness has pioneered the investigation and documentation of this crisis. With the invaluable research and writing of FTW's energy editor, Dale Allen Pfeiffer, I love the man, a geologist, and through my own travels and research in the United States, France, and Germany, we have drawn upon the expertise of those with decades of experience in the oil industry, many of whom have left it, independent scientists and academics having no connection to the energy industry, business and financial leaders, and international bodies such as the International Energy Agency. And actual world events, of course, to draw attention to what is the single most serious threat facing mankind in our entire history. It's my belief that as I speak to you tonight, the planet Earth is plus or minus 1 year at the all-time peak of hydrocarbon energy production. Simply put, we have used half of all the oil God placed on this planet, and every drop, every barrel extracted from the ground from now on will become progressively more expensive, of lesser quality, and much harder to obtain. We have picked all the low-hanging fruit. As all the experts agree, peak is something we will know only of a certainty as we view it in the rearview mirror. But the symptoms are all around us. The attacks of September the 11th were the pretext for the American and, to a lesser extent, the British and the Israeli empires to begin seizing by force those energy supplies needed to sustain their power, hegemony, whether regional or global, and their teetering economies. The attacks of 9/11 were accomplished through an amazing orchestration of logistics and personnel. Former National Security Aide and Counterterror Advisor Richard Clark has postulated that such a conspiracy could never be kept a secret. Too many people, he said, would have had to have been involved. On this point, I disagree with Clark completely, and point to the fact that the Manhattan Project, which developed the atom bomb, and the Stealth Fighter Project were both successfully kept secret. The numbers of people involved in both of those projects far exceeded the numbers of people within the United States government required to execute September the 11th. However, I must, in the same breath, express a deep debt of gratitude to Richard Clark, for in his book, Against All Enemies, he left a compelling trail of breadcrumbs. Oh, did he? Contradictions to the sworn testimony of our highest leaders and hard evidence, which provided me with much of the information needed to say that not only can I name some of the government officials, and I will tonight, who perpetrated those attacks, I can also identify the prime suspect, or Mr. Big, who played the command role in executing them. Mr. Clark is not a stupid man, and I can only conclude that he left those crumbs for others to find. While these attacks were arguably one of the most serious homicides ever committed, the investigation and prosecution of that case by means other than Dick Cheney's war that will not end in our lifetimes has never even approached the legal and logical standards governing all such investigations. No real case has ever been made that would pass first muster of even a junior district attorney anywhere. Without such a court process, we are forced to employ analogies and metaphors but there remains to us the most successful fundamental strategy for the prosecution of criminal behavior, demonstrating that a suspect or suspects did or did not possess the means, the motive, and the opportunity to commit the crime. To date, the case that 9/11 was perpetrated solely by Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda has never been proved, even to the most rudimentary standards. In fact, some 35 months after the attacks, there has not been a single successful 9/11 prosecution anywhere in the world. Not one. The only conviction that had been secured, a German prosecution against Munir el-Mutasaddeq, charged with aiding the so-called Hamburg cell of Mohammed Atta, was overturned in 2004 because the U.S. government refused to produce key witnesses such as Khalid Sheikh Mohammed or Ramzi bin al-Shib and other evidence relevant to the charges. Every defendant in a Western criminal case has the right to examine the evidence used against him and to cross-examine witnesses. To the general public, as well as to the 9/11 research community, the mysterious and inexplicable failure of the nation's air defenses on the day of 9/11 remains the most glaring and gaping hole in the King Commission's account and in the government's version of events. Scrambling fighter aircraft was a routine occurrence for years before 9/11. The Associated Press has told us that fighter aircraft were scrambled and flying beside errant commercial and private air traffic within minutes of the slightest deviation, some 67 times in the calendar year prior to June 1, 2001. This is one of many areas where the Kane Commission not only failed to look, but actually altered evidence in the preparation of its final report. For me, the pivotal evidence absolutely demonstrating direct government complicity in and management of the attacks was found in a number of undisputed yet virtually unaddressed war games that I will show were being conducted, coordinated, and or controlled directly by Vice President Dick Cheney and or his immediate staff on the morning of September the 11th. The names of those war games are known to include Vigilant Guardian, Vigilant Warrior, Northern Guardian, Northern Vigilance, and Tripod 2. All have been reported on by major press organizations relying on undisputed quotes from participating military personnel. They have also been confirmed by NORAD press releases. All except for Northern Vigilance and Tripod 2 had to do with hijacked airliners inside the continental United States, specifically within the Northeast Air Defense Sector, where all four 9/11 hijackings occurred. And these exercises were all running on the morning of 9/11. These exercises caused FAA air traffic controllers to go, "Oh my God, we have as many as 11 hijacks. We don't know where to send the Air Force." Other reports identified as many as 22 possible hijackings. According to a clear record, some of these exercises involved commercial airline hijackings, in some cases false blips were deliberately inserted onto FAA and military radar screens, and they were present during at least the first attacks. This effectively paralyzed fighter response because with only 8 fighters available, 8, and they fly in pairs, in the region, there were as many as 22 possible hijackings taking place. Other exercises, specifically Northern Vigilance, had pulled significant fighter resources away from the Northeast U.S. just before 9/11, into northern Canada and Alaska. In addition, a close reading of key news stories published in the spring of 2004 revealed for the first time that some of these drills were live fly exercises. Think about that, where actual aircraft, likely flown by remote control, were simulating the behavior of hijacked airliners in real life. All of this as the real attacks began. The fact that these exercises had never been systematically and thoroughly explored in the mainstream press or publicly by Congress, or at least publicly in any detail by the so-called Independent 9/11 Commission, made me think that they could be the holy grail of 9/11. That's exactly what they turned out to be. Only one war game exercise, Vigilant Guardian, was mentioned in a footnote to the Kane Commission report, and then it was deliberately mislabeled as an exercise intended to intercept Russian bombers instead of a hijack exercise in the Northeast sector. Even then, a deliberate lie was told to the American people as NORAD Commander Ralph Eberhardt General Ralph Eberhardt testified to the commission that the exercise actually expedited U.S. Air Force response during the attacks. When Michael Caine, K-A-N-E, no relation to Thomas Caine, a brilliant young New York activist and budding investigative reporter, approached General Eberhardt on my behalf or on FTW's behalf as a journalist at the hearing and asked for information on the other exercise, General Eberhardt's only response was, "No comment." And an additional non-military biowarfare exercise called Tripod 2 being set up in Manhattan on September 11th was under the direct coordination of FEMA and, by White House directive, the immediate control of the Vice President. The setup for that exercise conveniently placed a fully staffed FEMA, New York City, and Department of Justice command post on Manhattan's Pier 29 in time for it to be conveniently used as the command post after the Twin Towers had collapsed. There are many, many areas where the official account and findings of the Caine Commission are contradicted by hard evidence. Official records, mainstream news investigations, and even sworn testimony, both the Los Angeles Times and the New York Times, have noted some of the lesser but no less glaring inconsistencies. In my book, Crossing the Rubicon, I'll provide you with many, many more. In my book, I will make the following points. One, I will name Richard Cheney as the prime suspect in the mass murders of 9/11 and will establish that not only was he a planner of the attacks, but also that on the day of the attacks, he was running a completely separate, parallel command, control, and communication system, which was superseding any orders being issued by the National Military Command Center in the Pentagon, or the White House Situation Room, even. To accomplish that end, he relied on a redundant and superior communication system maintained by the United States Secret Service in or near the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, the bunker to which he and National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice were reportedly rushed after Flight 175 struck the South Tower. I will demonstrate that the Secret Service possessed radar screens which gave them and the Vice President, whose side they never left, with real-time information as good or better than any available to the Pentagon or the FAA. There are records showing that the Secret Service has all the same radar screens, better ones than the military and the FAA. I will demonstrate that in what are called national special security events, the United States Secret Service is the supreme U.S. agency for operational control with complete authority over the military and all civilian agencies. I will establish conclusively that in May of 2001, by presidential order, Richard Cheney was put in direct command and control of all war game and field exercise training and scheduling through several agencies, especially FEMA. This also extended to all of the conflicting and overlapping NORAD drills that day. I will also demonstrate that the Tripod 2 exercise being set up, they say, on September the 10th in Manhattan, was directly connected to Dick Cheney's role, as expressed above by a White House directive placing him in charge of all planning for attacks, terrorism attacks, and weapons of mass destruction. I will also prove conclusively that a number of public officials at the national and New York City levels, including then Mayor Richard Giuliani, were aware that Flight 175 was en route to Lower Manhattan for 20 minutes and did nothing, absolutely nothing, to order the evacuation of or warn the occupants of the World Trade Center. One military officer, who I have spoken to, and I will identify him in the book, had to leave his post in the middle of the attacks and place a private call to his brother, who worked in the World Trade Center, and warning him to get the hell out of the building. That was apparently because it was an act of desperation, apparently because no other part of the system was taking any action to warn anybody. I will also show that the Israeli and British governments acted as partners with the highest levels of the American government to help in the preparation and very possibly the actual execution of the attacks. I now have to say a few words about Israel. Israel is a country. Judaism is a religion. Let me say that again. Israel is a country. Judaism is a religion. It is no more proper to say that the actions of the Israeli government are above criticism than it is to say that criticism of the American government is a criticism of all Americans. There are many direct connections between Israeli intelligence activities and the events of September the 11th, including a report from the Drug Enforcement Administration showing that more than 100 Israeli covert operatives, I have the DEA report, it's real, it's a real report, were functioning inside the United States just before and during the attacks. Some of these operatives were placed in extremely close proximity to four of the 9/11 hijackers, including Mohammed Atta, al-Shihi, al-Hazmi, and al-Midar, for those of you who know the names. 9/11 hijackers in South Florida and San Diego. Israeli companies such as Amdocs, Comverse, and Odigo had direct connections to the events of 9/11. A former Israeli anti-terror operative, I say former in quotes, was on board American Flight 11 and was killed. To say that Israel played a criminal role in the attacks is not the same thing as saying that Israel perpetrated the attacks. A key question asked by any homicide investigator is cui bono. That's Latin for who benefits. And on this account, we can find only three countries, United States, Britain, and Israel, that have never wavered in their support of everything that has transpired since 9/11 on the international scene. Tonight, even as I speak to you here, an Israeli spy scandal is spreading through the highest levels of the Pentagon, and revelations from breaking news stories strongly suggest that the information being provided to the Israeli government carried with it the sanctions of some of the same people that I have charged in crossing the Rubicon with perpetrating the attacks of September the 11th. Tonight, I predict that the current scandal will overlap and connect with the recent arrest by South African authorities of Sir Mark Thatcher, son of former British Prime Minister, the Baroness Margaret Thatcher, for his role in sponsoring an aborted coup in the West African nation of Equatorial Guinea. The motive, British commercial acquisition of oil rights in a region that, as I have been writing for over 2 years now, is destined to become the next regional zone of confrontation. West African nations from sub-Saharan Africa to Nigeria to Sierra Leone to Sao Tome and Principe to Chad to Cameroon to Angola are all feverish oil rush boom towns where nations, money, military might, covert operations, and intrigue are converging with lightning speed to control oil reserves. Although much smaller than the reserves of the Middle East, these African reserves are critical swing and lesser suppliers of oil in a world where, as we too well know now, the removal of just 1 million barrels a day from global supply can wreak economic havoc. I will say one more thing before leaving the subject of 9/11 tonight. I, like many Americans and many people around the world, have serious lingering questions about the collapse of the Twin Towers and what it was that actually struck the Pentagon and what in the name of God it was that caused the collapse of WTC-7, World Trade Center 7, a building that wasn't hit by anything. Unfortunately, the physical evidence was quickly destroyed, and scientific analysis is not available to us to answer these important questions. In order to make the strongest legal case possible, I have avoided discussions of physical evidence, open to acrimonious debate and scientific challenge, and chosen to do what any good police officer or detective must always do: keep your eye on the suspect. It does not take a scientist to prove that George Bush, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Condi Rice, General Ralph Eberhardt, General Richard Myers, FBI Director Robert Mueller, John Ashcroft, and George Tenet lied to the American people. There is a record that proves this, and that is the record I will present to you with all 1,000 footnotes in Crossing the Rubicon. But on the subject of WTC-7, I will in my book explain why that particular building had to be destroyed. And although I cannot prove to you how the Twin Towers will collapse, I will also show you who performed the requisite scientific studies that would have been essential to pull off that feat. I'm going to read you one quote and shut up. Quote is from James Kenneth Galbraith. You might have heard the name before. There are few economists in that family. In November 2002, James Kenneth Galbraith wrote an article titled "The Unbearable Costs of Empire." None of these problems will be cured so long as war remains our dominant political theme. But serious though they are, they pale in comparison with the larger problem of the international trade and financial order under conditions of permanent war. It is a straightforward fact that if global oil production starts to decline, but U.S. consumption does not, everyone else will be required to cut purchases and uses of oil. But how can oil prices be held stable for Americans yet made to rise for everyone else? Only by a policy of continuing depreciation of everyone else's currency. Such a policy of dollar hegemony amid worldwide financial instability, of crushing debt burdens and deflation throughout the developing world, is perverse. It will make our trading partners' exports cheap, render their imports dear, and keep their real wages low. It will price American goods out of the world markets and lead to unsustainable dependence on foreign capital. It will be a policy, in short, of beggar all of our neighbors while we live alone in increasing idleness inside a dollar bubble. This is the policy that Bush and Cheney are imposing on the rest of the world, but they cannot make it last. It will make lives miserable elsewhere, generating ever more resistance, terrorism, and military management. Meanwhile, we will not experience even gradual exposure to the changing energy balance. Compared with this future, a new commitment to collective security, to a new world financial structure, to a rational energy and transportation policy, and spending to meet our domestic needs would be a bargain. At the end of the Constitutional Convention, Benjamin Franklin was asked what type of government the framers had given our republic. He famously replied, "A republic, if you can keep it." In 49 BC, Julius Caesar crossed the Rubicon. The Roman Empire died. Our task is not to keep our republic, but to take it back. Thank you.
That was Mike Rupert, author of the just-released book, Crossing the Rubicon. In his book, he lays out his serious allegations on over 600 pages, backed up by over 1,000 footnotes. Mike Rupert is a former detective with the L.A. Police Department. He now is an independent investigator. His website is fromthewilderness.com. Crossing the Rubicon has been called the detective story of the century. Rupert treats his readers as a jury and hopes to be able to present his evidence in court. You can find more information on Mike Rupert on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can get a one-hour tape or CD of the talk by Mike Rupert by calling us. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your tape or CD order is the only support we receive and makes it possible for us to stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 1-877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape or CD by mail or credit card, by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 1-877-882-8273. My name is Mariah Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.